Thank you for standing by. This conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, they may disconnect at this time. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you. Well, welcome everybody to the May 2008 CHARM teleconference. Today we have Dr. Larry Esposito with us, and he'll be talking about the history of Saturn's rings. I'll give you a little information about Larry. He's the principal investigator of UVIS, the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph on Cassini, and he was also chair of the Voyager Rings Working Group. As a member of the Pioneer Saturn Imaging Group, he discovered Saturn's F ring. He's been a participant in numerous U.S., Russian, and European space missions, and used the Hubble telescope for its first observations of the planet Venus. I could go on and on about Larry, but I think I'll let him start his talk.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jane.
You're welcome.
Yeah, very flattering. I'm going to be talking about the history of Saturn's rings, and as part of that, I'm going to give an update on some of the more recent results, and also say a little bit about that ultraviolet imaging spectrograph that we built here at the University of Colorado, our experiment on Cassini. So if you're with me, you're probably looking at the first slide, which says History of Saturn's Rings. So let's go to the next slide, which shows a picture of the Cassini spacecraft. And the spacecraft is about the size of a small bus, as you probably know. The biggest part of it, Ecometer boom, which is 11 meters, about 40 feet long, and of course unfurled when we were in space. But somewhere in the midsection of this, you can see what's called the remote sensing palette, and that includes all the cameras and spectrometers, and the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph is tucked there on the remote sensing palette up against the spacecraft and co-aligned with the camera and the infrared spectrometer. So that's the instrument that we built here at Colorado, and it has been operating for now almost 4 years in orbit around Saturn, and I'm going to show you some of our results, also some of the implications about the history of Saturn's rings. So the next slide is just a retrospective of the launch of Cassini, which was on 15 October 1997. It was a night launch, and you can see the night sky lit up by the launch of the Titan IV here with the light from the exhaust flame reflecting off the clouds off over Cape Canaveral at the Kennedy Space Center. Beautiful sight, and that's how we started our trip to Saturn, oh, more than 10 years ago. And on the right-hand side, you can see a top view of the solar system, which shows the path of Cassini, not a very direct one, which eventually, after almost 7 years, arrived at Saturn on July 1st, 2004. And aboard that Cassini mission was our spectrometer, which is shown in the next slide. It's a rectangular piece of metal with a picture of a buffalo on the side. The buffalo is the emblem of the University of Colorado. We put that there as well as inscribing not our initials, but our names in the aluminum, and which is now in orbit around the planet Saturn. And the business end of the telescope is facing out toward the right. Those apertures, one circular and four rectangular, are where the telescopes look through, aligned with the cameras, at the planet Saturn and any other target that we're interested in, particularly Saturn's rings. I want to pause for just a second. Anybody have a question or a comment? Hearing none, let's go on to the next slide. Some people ask, how big is it really? And the answer is it just meets FAA regulations for undersea luggage. So it's about the size of a small carry-on. Of course, when we take it place to place before we launched it to Saturn, we didn't slide it under the seat. It got its own seat on the airplane. So the next slide is an artist's conception of the Cassini spacecraft going in orbit around Saturn on July 1st. And you can see the main engines firing here as the spacecraft was above Saturn's rings. You click, you'll get the date on that. You click on your presentation again. Go to the objective of the Cassini mission, which of course is the entire Saturnian system, not just everything in it, but how the pieces interact. And on the top part of that slide, you can see the various elements of the system all to scale, with Saturn, just the edge of the planet here visible, showing it is truly the biggest, the giant planet of the system. And in front of that, the various moons of Saturn, including the biggest one, Titan, and some of the very tiny moons on the left-hand side. You can see Pan, which is a moon that's embedded in Saturn's rings, which are shown as background here. And the Cassini mission and the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, which we call UVIS, had as a target the entire system. So both investigations, the big mission and our particular investigation, are looking at the whole system, which you can see once again down in the bottom here with a more distant view, Saturn, its rings surrounding it, some of the very thin rings, including the E ring, of which covers the moon Enceladus, and off the screen, some of the more distant moons would be found, Titan, Hyperion, Iapetus, Phoebe, etc. Next slide here is showing the scale of Saturn relative to the Earth-Moon system. So we've got Saturn with one end of the rings near the Earth. The other end of the rings would almost reach to the Earth's moon. This next picture is an artist's conception of Saturn's moon Rhea, and surrounded by a thin ring of chunks of rock and ice. And we're not quite certain that the artist is correct. Several of the teams on Cassini have noticed the presence of this ring, but not by photographing it. That's why we have an artist's conception, but by watching as the spacecraft passed close by Rhea, that some of the particles in Saturn's radiation belts, like the Van Allen belts of the Earth, were removed selectively when the spacecraft passed near Rhea on one side and then again on the other side. So something that would be, that sort of phenomenon would be caused by several rings of material around the moon. And in fact, that's how the rings around the planet Uranus were discovered, in the same way, showing symmetric blocking of the light from a star in that case. Well, unfortunately, the Cassini cameras have taken several close looks at Rhea, long, long duration exposures, and have not seen anything resembling a ring. And so the only way to accommodate, to reconcile both those observations, is that the ring is made up of many large chunks of ice, like shown in this artist's conception. And if that were the case, unless you were very close to them, you wouldn't be able to see them in the Cassini pictures, but they would still at the same time absorb and remove enough charged radiation so that that could explain how Cassini made those measurements when it flew by. So in the history of Saturn's rings, we even have the possibility that not just Saturn, but its moons have rings. And if that were the case, the ring around Rhea was probably formed when a small moon in the neighborhood was shattered by a meteorite. In fact, that's one of the major theories for the formation of Saturn's rings, which I'm going to come back to in a second. I'm going to move on to the next slide. While we look at this beautiful picture of Saturn's rings and Titan and the moon Rhea here in this view, anybody have a question or a comment?
Does it have any kind of an atmosphere?
What
Rhea?
As far as we know, we didn't see any atmosphere. We looked for scattered light and also light emitted by oxygen atoms. And with our investigation, we set a pretty strict upper limit for Rhea's atmosphere. So as far as we can tell, there's no detectable atmosphere on Rhea.
Wow, that is an amazing picture.
Yes, next slide. Here's another one that's pretty good, too. This is the moon Dione against the limb of Saturn. At the bottom left, you can see Saturn's rings, which are just about seen edge-on, and they would be possible to ignore except for the fact that the sun shines through them and is casting a shadow, which you can see in the upper right behind the moon. See what I've got in the next slide here, another lovely view of Saturn, its rings, and this moon. I can't remember exactly at this moment, but one of the small moons captured in the frame. Next slide. This is one of the more famous pictures of Saturn and its rings, and it's taken during a very special opportunity that occurred only once during the mission, when the spacecraft was very distant from Saturn and caught in Saturn's shadow. So this is a picture the spacecraft took, a long exposure image looking back towards Saturn with the sun behind it. And in the lower left, you can see a little bright spot right on the edge of the planet, and that's just the light from the sun refracted through the very upper atmosphere of Saturn and scattered by high hazes made of little particles. But for the most part, the sun is hidden, which allows the cameras to measure very exactly some of the very dim features. And you can see here several rings around Saturn. You can see the main rings in the center. Those are the ones that we showed earlier in the picture. But outside of them, two very dim rings. The G ring is the closer one, and outside is the ring E. Now, I can only say that the rings of Saturn were named in alphabetical order, so there's not a good way to remember them, but this E ring is the same one I showed in the picture that's associated with the moon Enceladus, and they both start with E, so that's one way to possibly remember that. And these rings are made up of small particles about the size of the particles in the smoke from a cigarette, or small particles about the size of human hair, which tend to scatter light about 0.001 of an inch, tend to scatter light in the forward direction. So they're particularly visible in this sort of perspective where the sun is behind the planet, and because the sun is hidden during this moment, we're able to take a long exposure and see those rings. So you see the diffuse E ring, it's the outermost ring there, which I'll say more about. And you look on the left-hand side of that, between the E and the G rings, there's a little white dot.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the next slide, which we've blown up here. And that, as you can see in the upper left-hand corner, is a dot with another smaller dot next to it. In fact, some people have been calling this a pale blue dot because that's actually the Earth and the Earth's moon that was caught in this particular photograph in the long exposure. So even all the way from Saturn, we can see the Earth, if we're lucky, looking back towards the sun, and the Earth is just barely visible in this picture. It gives the same sort of perspective that Carl Sagan talked about when Voyager looked back after flying by the giant planets in 1990, and he wrote a book called The Pale Blue Dot, and just to show how tiny and insignificant the Earth is in the cosmic perspective, but at the same time, it still has a slight bluish color, which is indicating the atmosphere and the ocean of the Earth, which makes it possible to live here. So we are getting somewhat of this same cosmic perspective from Cassini, although we're in orbit in Saturn, and Saturn is the second largest planet in the solar system. We're still able to get some idea of the vastness of space and how small and precious the Earth-Moon system is in that. Look at that
question.
Yeah.
Could the person who's asking the questions please identify themselves so that when we do the transcripts, there'll be a name associated with it? Thanks.
Yeah. Earl Kyle, Solar System Ambassador, Rochester, Minnesota. On the previous slide, why is it that we're looking at the backside of the planet? It looks like you can still see superimposed the ring structure there.
Right, because the rings are not completely uniform. and they vary in their transparency. And so more or less light leaks through the rings, even when you're looking on the dark side. We first observed this with Pioneer 11 back in 1979, which was a surprise to us then. But Voyager in 1980 and 81 also took pictures of the dark side of the rings, which are not completely dark, just as you can see here. So I'm going to move ahead to the next slide. There's the one with the insert of the Earth and Moon. And now here's a close-up of the E ring, which is right in the center of the E ring. You see a tiny black dot with a little extension, a white extension, toward the bottom. If you're looking at that, that is the moon Enceladus, and that white feature that we're seeing is light scattered by the volcanic eruptions on Enceladus, which are coming from its south pole. And those we can see are just right in the center of the E-ring. The E-ring is a little bit cut up and not perfectly smooth near that, so it's both disturbed and, we later learned, created by the materials erupting off the surface of Enceladus. Next slide. I wanted to show you a picture we've made with our own experiment here, the Colorado experiment. We have an imaging spectrograph, so that means it's possible for us to take pictures. And the pictures that we make are in the ultraviolet, which, as you probably know, is invisible to the human eye. So we make pictures that of things that couldn't be seen by humans but are visible in the ultraviolet. And the way that we make a picture is not by taking a single snapshot, but moving our pointing of our experiment across the planet. So in our investigation, we only have 64 pixels. Everybody talks about a camera with megapixels, a million or more. You probably wouldn't buy one today that only had, you know, a half a meg on it. But we only have 64 pixels. That's one of the limitations of space. And those pixels in this drawing called Saturn's Northern Lights would start at the bottom and go up to the top. So pixel number 0 would be at the bottom and pixel number 63 would be at the top. And what we do is we successively expose the planet by moving the slit from the left to the right. And then in the computer, we put all those columns together and we use our 64 pixels to make a picture of Saturn. And of course, it's not as good as the Cassini cameras, which do have pixels, but we're able to see in wavelengths that they can't, and also we're able to look at one time at 1,028 different colors, different wavelengths in the ultraviolet. So what you're seeing here are two successive pictures of Saturn, one on the left and one on the right, made in that way where we build them up one line at a time. And we have used the colors that humans can see, oranges and blues, to map out the emissions from the atmosphere of Saturn. And the blue particularly is the emission from hydrogen atoms. And so what we're seeing here is the glow of the Saturn atmosphere, the northern lights of Saturn, even though we're looking at the south pole of Saturn. The aurora and the Earth also occur in Antarctica. So essentially what we would call aurora here on the Earth, we're seeing exactly the same, and we're using both the imaging capability of the spectrometer and its ability to distinguish constituents in the atmosphere by the color of light they're emitting to make this picture. And you can probably see between the left and the right that the aurora has changed a little bit if you look inside that blue circle, the interior. And so we're actually watching an auroral display here on the planet Saturn. Next slide. So I want to talk a little bit about one other important aspect of the system before I come back to the rings, and that's about the satellites. And here the satellites are shown for scale against the United States. If you're looking at this, you can see that the in the lower right-hand corner, is a dotted circle, which is the size of the Earth's moon, and then the big yellow circle is the size of Titan, which is significantly larger than the Earth's moon. You can see that the moon Rhea is about as big as Texas, and that Enceladus is about as big as Iowa, and Mimas is about as big as Georgia, and the moon Phoebe would fit across Florida. Some of the smaller moons, like Pandora, are not even as big as New Jersey, and some of them more comparable to the smaller northeastern states. So let me say what I can say about some of the recent results on Saturn's moons. And this next picture you're looking at is a grayscale image of the surface of Titan that's made by the side-looking radar, the radar on Cassini. And you can see that Titan is just completely covered in this region by long dunes. I'd like to say sand dunes, but they're probably not made of sand on Titan. They're probably made up of frozen hydrocarbons, grease or gunk, that collects into tiny little particles and is then blown around by the wind and forms these dunes in the same way that the dunes form in the Sahara on the Earth. Look at our next slide. This is not a radar image, but a camera image from the descending Huygens spacecraft, which, as you probably know, was carried to Saturn, built by the Europeans and carried to Saturn as part of the Cassini mission, and separated from Cassini just about Christmas Day, 2004, and on January 15th, 2005, landed on the surface of Titan. And so that little probe that the Europeans had built landed on the surface, and as it descended, it took a series of photographs where several have been put together here to show that the surface of Titan includes what look like rivers and streams, tributary streams, runoff network. So presumably it's raining on Titan, at least occasionally, to cut these streams in the surface that look every bit like rivers in the Appalachians, for example. And when we can measure the altitude of the surface by looking at two different angles, we see that all of these streams run downhill into the flatter area that's in the bottom and lower left. And we thought that might be something like a sea that all these channels drained into. But as it turned out, that's where Huygens did land, in that darker, flatter region, and it actually was solid, not liquid there, although when the Huygens probe sat there for a while, it was warm enough that it heated up some of the surface, and we saw methane and ethane evaporating. So perhaps the surface is a little bit slushy or crusty there with a methane underneath, and we think it's methane rain that's cut the channels that we see in this picture. And I'll say more about methane, because it plays a role on Titan very much like water in the Earth. On the Earth, there's a hydrologic cycle. There's potentially methane underneath the surface in reservoirs and aquifers, which evaporates into the atmosphere, forms clouds, and rains out, and the floods created by those rains cut these channels. And was told to me once in Europe, that the rain on Titan is predominantly methane. Go to the next slide here. So also the methane can collect into larger bodies, and here's a picture. It looks like a lake, almost certainly a lake of methane on the surface of Titan. You can see that it's flooded the lower-lying areas, and that there are some islands that stick out in a crenellated seashore, maybe like Lake Powell that we see in the west here. And even going beyond Titan, I wanted to show some images of the moon Iapetus, which has been an object of interest for many years because it has one very dark side and one very bright side. And at close-up, these are views from just in the last year, the cameras are showing that this dark and black distribution continues even at high resolution. So there are features here that are just tens of kilometers across, and they're either black or white. There don't seem to be any shades of gray. And in fact, in some of the craters, we can see that half of it is bright and half of it is dark. And the explanation that we have for this, next slide will show some close-ups here, the same sort of thing. The explanation is that wherever it was dark on Iapetus, days are very long on Iapetus, and the sun shines for a long time, and where it's dark, it gets warmer, like wearing a black coat on a sunny day. And where it gets warmer, that evaporates the surface ices, particularly water, and the surface therefore evaporates. The water evaporates, it's mixed with some dark material that's left behind, sort of a slag. And the water vapor in the atmosphere is the molecules are carried around on whatever wind might exist, and then they snow out where it's colder. So we get a movement of material, ice, from the darker regions to the brighter regions. And of course, when the ice leaves the darker regions, that makes them even darker because they're less icy. And where it snows, it becomes even brighter. So where it snowed, then because it's brighter, the temperatures are cooler, and that tends to attract even more ice. And where it's dark, it gets even hotter, and that tends to evaporate more ice. And we can imagine, after some millions, maybe billions of years, that the surface of Iapetus, if it eventually had some shades of gray, they've all been driven to the extreme states of either being darker than coal or brighter than snow. Next slide. So I'm about ready to go back and do some close-ups on Enceladus and the E-ring. Are there questions or comments?
This is Kevin Jadagis, ambassador in Albuquerque, New Mexico. If you look at that last picture, I mean, it does look like they're kind of blowouts. What's the relief between the dark and the light? Is there a great relief change?
So, in this part of Iapetus, the relief is less than hundreds of meters, and as you say, it could be that the impacts on the surface have excavated through that layer of ice that's formed on the top and exposed some of the darker material underneath, and there's a thought that that might be depths of 1 to 10 meters here. But I don't believe on the stereo there's enough information to actually measure that better. Is that answering your question?
It does.
Let's go to the next slide, which is a picture of the moon Enceladus, taken from the dark side with the south pole on the left, and you can see that there are definitely jets of gas shooting off from Enceladus. This is a close-up of the same phenomenon we saw in that big picture of the E-ring, where the moon Enceladus is going through the E-ring and at the same time ejecting material. And to go to the next slide, I'd like to explain how we were able to observe that plume on Enceladus, that eruption. And it was an indirect method we used with the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, where instead of looking directly at Enceladus or at the erupting plume, like in the picture, which is in the previous picture, is from the cameras, instead we watched a star, which is that yellow star, which, as seen by the spacecraft, appeared to set and then rise behind Enceladus. And overplotted on that is the squiggly line, which is the brightness of the star. And a very interesting thing happened is that the star, instead of just blinking out when it got to the edge of Enceladus, gradually declined in brightness, showing that there's something lying between us and that is the Cassini spacecraft and the star, very near to Enceladus, which is a very thin atmosphere of Enceladus created by these eruptions. And now, it's not even a complete atmosphere. It's very patchy on the other side of Enceladus. We didn't see the same phenomenon. Look at the next slide. You can see a movie that shows some of these eruptions occurring. And because of our observations of the star and because of direct observations made on Cassini as it flew through the plume, we know the composition of that plume, which is mostly water vapor. So it's mostly steam. And the water vapor is probably condensing to make little grains of ice. And based on our estimates of the amount of water and the amount of ice, the material that's being blown off the surface or out of the interior of Enceladus is sufficient to actually make the E-ring of Saturn. So we now think this phenomenon you're seeing in this movie here of jets of gas blowing grains of ice off of the moon Enceladus make that ring that we see in the pictures that were taken from Saturn's shadow. So the E-ring and Enceladus are not just, you know, fortuitously both starting with the letter E, but the moon Enceladus is almost certainly the source of the material in that ring around Saturn. So here we go. Talked about two rings so far. The possible Rhea ring, which is clumps of chunks of ice and rock from a shattered moon that's orbiting that moon, Rhea. And here, from the interior of Enceladus, grains of ice that are ejected that form the ring E, E-ring of Saturn. Let's look at the next slide. So that sort of leads up to a question that I've been investigating for a number of years, and we've been using the Cassini data from the cameras and the other experiments, and particularly from our experiment, UVIS, to say something about the history of the rings. So this slide we're looking at says, Cassini observations show Saturn's rings may be ancient. So what are the rings anyway? You've probably gotten an idea from just what I'm talking about. They're made up of billions of small pieces of ice orbiting Saturn. And sometimes when I think about Carl Sagan, I even say billions and billions of small pieces of ice, or maybe trillions even. And they are really interesting, not just because of their own beauty, but because they also resemble the disks from which planets are forming around other stars. And our experiment, UVIS, observes light that's reflected from Saturn's rings, and we also watch stars that pass behind the rings the same way we watch that star that passed behind Enceladus to measure the composition and the amount of material in the plume from Enceladus. Now, here's the interesting point. Voyager, just a quarter century, had really the first close-up views of Saturn's rings, and a big surprise from that was how youthful the rings looked, how young looked. I mean, young in a geologic sense, so, you know, maybe 100 million years as old as the dinosaurs or something, but, you know, more than 10 times younger than Saturn itself. And this was a surprise, and we were hard-pressed to explain how the rings around Saturn could have originated so recently in cosmic history, just 100 million years ago. And there were ideas that had to do with shattering a moon of Saturn, like the explanation for the Rhea rings, and another explanation that a comet might have come too close to Saturn and being torn apart by Saturn's gravity, and that the pieces remained in the ring. And the amazing thing, if we go to the next slide, is that the rings, which were a 17th century puzzle, and here I've just got some drawings that were made in the 17th century after the discovery of the telescope. The early telescope makers looked at Saturn and its rings and couldn't quite figure out what was going on, although we, with retrospect, can see that all of these pictures here, the rings, are of a planet that has a ring around it, a flat ring, but also has seasons, so that sometimes the rings are wide open, and at other seasons, like near the equinox, the rings are pointing directly toward the sun and the earth, and so might even disappear. But this puzzle was eventually solved by Christian Huygens, who the Huygens spacecraft is named after, but they remain a puzzle in the 21st century. Now, here I've got, if you're looking at this, a blue and red picture of Saturn's rings. And this is an artificial picture in several ways. The first is that it was made by the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, and we didn't actually see the whole expanse of the rings. We just took a cut to what would be the midline of this from left to right. And to make the picture, we assume that Saturn's rings are symmetric, are cylindrically symmetric, or azimuthally symmetric. So we assume the rings were the same all the way around the planet. And the second thing is that this image was taken in reflected light in the ultraviolet, which, as I said, humans can't see. So if we had been on the spacecraft, we wouldn't have been greeted with this particular view. But that also is an advantage to us, because then we can pick whatever artificial colors we like. And so we picked reddish colors to show the emission of hydrogen, which is filling space and shining through the rings. So everywhere there's a gap in the rings, we have a red light seen there. And we picked blue to represent the spectrum of water ice. So wherever the rings are this bright blue color, that's where the ice is very pure in the rings. And then we used the computer to turn all that information into a color photograph based on real information, but not really how a human would see it. In fact, I'm told butterflies can see in the ultraviolet, so it's sort of a butterfly's eye view of Saturn's rings. And you see there's incredible structure in the rings, that the composition brightness of the rings changes from point to point. And this is something, if the rings were hundreds of millions of years old, would no longer be true. If there were any original variations in the rings, because the billions of particles keep running into each other, colliding on their orbits, sometimes several times a day, any original coloring of the rings would be washed out. So just looking at this picture, we know that there are phenomena occurring that are coloring the rings and are resisting nature's efforts to smooth everything out. So this was just one of the first indications that not only are the rings young, but they're even younger than we thought from the Voyager data. Go to the next slide. This is the one that shows several waves in the rings. So this is sort of corrugated. On the left-hand side, there's a density wave in the rings, a wave that's propagating like a sound wave through the rings. And on the right-hand side, there's a bending wave in the rings, which is a corrugation, both of these excited by gravity from Saturn's nearby moons. And if you were sitting there in Saturn, it would be like sitting at the beach. You would see these waves come and go past you. And just another indication of the dynamic nature of the rings, even more dynamic than we expected. So you might think from that the rings are even younger than we thought. Maybe, you know, they're not even as old as the dinosaurs. Maybe they're as old only as the Australopithecines, one of the human ancestors. This causes kind of a problem, and in fact, in the data, the observations, we even see differences in the rings between now and 25 years ago. And so the idea that we had when Voyager flew by, that the rings all look so young and the process are proceeding so rapidly, is because they really are young and they were created just in a cosmic eye blink just some millions of years ago, doesn't work, because we don't think that the rings have been created in the last 25 years. So paradoxically, the fact that we see very youthful features in the rings means that this explanation of the rings' history as being created quite recently, cosmically, doesn't work. And in fact, we're seeing not only very youthful ages, but ages in between, so that we're seeing a whole range of ages of phenomena in the rings that are inconsistent with a single creation event. See what I've got here. So I want to talk a little bit about how moons interact with rings and come back to this question of how do we get out of this problem that the rings appear youthful, and in fact some places very, very young, but at the same time we can't fit that all together with a single event that created the rings. And there's an interesting relationship between the moons and the rings that are shown in this next slide here, where the gravity from two moons serves to hold the ring in place. And and essentially to shepherd the rings like a sheepdog would keep a herd of sheep in place. And in Saturn's rings, we definitely find, and in the rings of other planets, we definitely find rings held in place between the moons. So the moons have definitely a structural relationship to the rings, and as I said earlier, maybe also a genetic relationship, because if you shatter one of these moons, break it to pieces, that would leave a ring, and that may well be how the rings of Saturn formed. Now, maybe 15 years ago, Joshua Caldwell and I at the University of Colorado developed a numerical model of ring formation that was just based on this idea of shattering a moon to make a ring. Let's look at the next slide. Here's Saturn's F ring. This is the one that I discovered. And you can see that it's sitting between two of these shepherding moons, just like in the previous diagram. And here's some other images of the F ring. And this next one shows how the nearby moon, shepherding moon Prometheus, which is on the inside in between the F ring and the main rings, which are off to the right, is creating wiggles and structure in the rings.
Is there any, this is Kevin again from Albuquerque, is there any electromagnetic relationships between the rings and the moons?
For particles of this size, you can basically ignore static electricity. For the moons of Jupiter, there are some pieces of evidence that show electromagnetic effects are important. But for what we're seeing in these pictures, the electromagnetic effects are insignificant. For some of the smaller particles, though, the ones that are dust, like in the E-ring, it's possible that electromagnetic effects would have some implications. But here, it's mostly gravity that we're talking about. So I'm going to go to the next slide, which is one called collisional cascade. This was the idea that Caldwell and I had, that there's a sort of collisional cascade. You start out with big particles, moons of Saturn, and you break them up. And every time you break them up, you make a ring. The ring gets ground up to dust, but you smash another moon, make up a new ring. Unfortunately, as I said, this seems to go too fast. It uses up the ring material in just some hundreds of millions of years, which, you know, wasn't a huge problem 15 years ago when we first did this analysis, but now causes us some concern because we're asking ourselves, well, why have we been so lucky?
What slide are you on now?
It's called Collisional Cascade, if I escape.
Well, I don't have titles on my 33.
That's slide,
the slide
33. Okay, and I'm going to go back to my slideshow. So are you seeing it? Everybody's seeing it. Slide number 33, and the problem is, you know, we humans been so fortunate, you know, taking 4 billion years or so to evolve from the very first forms of life on Earth, and then eventually developing an intelligence and space flight, launching a spacecraft to the outer solar system, flying by Saturn just at the moment it happens to have rings. So this is a challenge which is similar to the one that at the same time we're also finding that there's no unique age in the rings, of the rings. And so we're having this problem of both, when did the rings form, and why are we so lucky to be there at the same time? So I'm going to go on to the next slide. Caldwell and I did some analysis of the evolution of these ring moon systems, showing the collisional cascade, and what you see in this chart is just the size of the largest ring fragment as a function of time, and what happens is the original material is very rapidly ground up into dust. The size of the largest surviving fragment goes to zero very quickly, and the various symbols here in lines are just the different mean, median, and mode of the distribution of particle sizes. So very quickly, in our simulation, in a time about a tenth of the age of the solar system, all those original moons would be broken to bits. In the meantime, there would be great rings around Saturn such as, like the ones we've photographed with Cassini and Voyager, but that would all come to an end very quickly in less than 10% of the age of the solar system. So I wanted to show you some, I'm going to come back to how do we answer that question, but our answer is based on some detailed investigations by Cassini of Saturn's F ring, and here the slide you're looking at now has four different views of Saturn's F ring showing various features within that look to me like clumps or maybe moons that are inside the F ring. And some of these are very short-lived. We photograph them and they are gone the next time we look. So that there seems to be, at least in Saturn's F ring, some sort of process that's creating aggregates, maybe even little moonlets in the rings that are short-lived. And we with UVIS have been looking at that, and this is sort of how we're coming to our answer of the question of what's the history of Saturn's rings. And we're trying to answer the question, basically, are Saturn's rings young or are Saturn's rings old? So I'm going to show you a movie here. If you're watching this, you'll see the star, which is a star that we've been watching, gradually start moving. It's a little clunky in my screen. If you go back, you can start that again. Yeah, that's a little better. The star is occulted, blocked by Saturn's F ring. And so just like before, as I talked about how we measured the Enceladus plume, by indirectly watching a star go behind it, we've been measuring the nature of Saturn's F ring by watching now more than 60 stars pass behind them. And here's an artist's simulation of a star passing behind the F ring, and you can see that the artist has drawn in a little moonlet, a little tiny moon, and when the star passes behind that, it blinks out. And naturally, that's what we observed also in Saturn's ring. So now I'm to the word slide, which says UVIS finds clumps and moonlets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what we did. Using these star occultations, we found clumps and moonlets in Saturn's F ring, 13 different events. Probably most of them are temporary aggregations, and one is a possible moonlet. And this potentially is the solution to the problem of the age of the rings. Now, I don't know where everybody's from. I know in Albuquerque they have a big recycling program. Certainly here in Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, recycling is very big. But this is a way potentially to make the rings last longer, is to recycle. And that is when you destroy a moon and make a ring, if the particles recycle by collecting again to make a new moon, that could be used again, could be shattered again to make a ring later. And so for this to happen, we need to have an alternate process that Josh Caldwell and I didn't consider 15 years ago in our collisional cascade. That is, we considered breaking up moons, but we didn't consider the pieces of moons coming back together to make new moons that could be then the source of future rings. So the story I'm heading toward here, the history of the rings, involves significant recycling like modern America. So this next slide shows some of these features that we're seeing in the rings, and we're back to squiggly diagrams here. You can keep in your mind the artist's conception, that movie that I showed before. And we have data here. We have a smooth line that's the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer, one of the spectrometers on Cassini, that's watching the same star that UVIS is watching. And amazingly, at one time, the light from the star pretty much blinks out. And that shows that it's not just a fluke or an error in our observations, but there's something that got between us and the star. And I've been giving names to these temporary aggregations. This one I'm calling Piwacket. And I'm using cat names because we're imagining that these clumps come and go again and again, so they have something like nine lives. And you probably remember Piwacket from the movie Bell, Book, and Candle. It's a familiar name. It's the name of of Kim Novak's Familiar. She plays a witch in that movie, a little black cat. Excuse me. So here's another star that we watched, Alpha Vir 34, the star Spica. And here we see two other features, which we call Butterball and Fluffy. And we have, you know, I'm still looking for nominations. We have features that still have numbers and don't have cat names yet. But basically what we're seeing when we watch stars pass behind Saturn's F ring is, one, the ring is different all the time. That's the dynamic nature of the ring. But occasionally, we have see a number of events which are not repeatable that show a lot of starlight blocked, sometimes with sharp edges like you can see in features 8 and 7 here. And we're interpreting these as temporary aggregations or as evidence for the fact that the processes go both ways. That is, competing with meteorites shattering the rings, there's also a process where the material, the pieces, come back together. So, in addition to that, in the F ring, we're also seeing features in the main ring, which have been called self-gravity wakes. And this is something we could never have done with Voyager, but because on Cassini we're in orbit around Saturn, we get to watch one star after another go behind the rings. And each one of them gives a cut through the rings, which is just like a CAT scan. We have scans through the rings at a variety of different angles, and just like with a CAT scan, you can turn that into a three-dimensional image. And in fact, we see in our data features that are too small to be seen by the cameras. And these are elongated transient clumps, what are called self-gravity wakes for historical reasons, and I'm going to show you some pictures of those in the next slide. So here's a numerical.
What slide are you on now?
So let me escape here. I don't see the numbers. When
I'll get it. Let's see.
So 42.
Yeah. Also, you keep referring to some video clips, and they weren't on the site that we downloaded, at least on my thing. So I'm not. Are you actually showing movies on?
I'm showing movies. I sent them to the site. We
they're
attached
not up
the movies.
There. I just downloaded it as you started.
So it's on the password protected site. So check your original email and you'll see a link to the password protected site, and it'll have and it's very case sensitive, and you'll be able to download two movies from there, as well as the original PowerPoint for repackaging.
Okay.
And the movie that we've watched so far, I think, is called Mittens.
All right, I'll get it later. Thanks.
Yeah, it's
Trina, this is Jane.
Yeah,
Trina, this is Jane. I wasn't able to get the mittens either, so maybe it's not up. Maybe it's on the one you've gone to, but I didn't find it either.
Yeah, it's on the password protected side. I just downloaded both the simulation and mittens, and they work just fine.
Oh, okay. Didn't.
So I apologize, but I'm glad it is possible to see them. So I've got one more movie to show, which is coming up soon, which is also going to be related to these self-gravity wakes. So the picture I'm showing now is slide 43. And on the left-hand side is one of these artificial color images of the rings. And the right-hand side of that is a numerical simulation of particles of two different sizes, red and blue. And what you can see is when we make a computer model of the rings, because the individual particles have gravity, they attract each other and the rings become very heterogeneous. You see all these structures in the rings, and what that means is when we take a tomographic view of the rings, we take this sort of CAT scan from our multiple occultations, we can build up the shapes and structures of that which is below the capability. It's invisible to the cameras. So we're proud of that capability. I'm going to move on to the next slide 44. So here's another artist's conception of what it would look like in Saturn's A ring if you looked at some of these temporary structures, and you see the particles tend to clump up. We always had a model of the rings that was simpler, that was more heterogeneous, where everything was uniform, But Saturn's rings are more complicated than we thought, and we can tell this because at some angles we can see through the rings and at other angles we can't. And that could only be the case if the rings are heterogeneous. And those tomographic pieces of information have put together here in this three-dimensional artist's view of the rings on slide 44.
Certain shepherding along with these large clumping, kind of like beading or...
I'm sorry, ask me again.
This is Kevin from Albuquerque. In looking at your three-dimensional view there, it appears that there's kind of like beading or gravitational, maybe some clumping, and you're talking about the clumping, but from clump to clump, is there like gravitational beading, I guess is the only word I can use, or maybe some trailing, trailering going on?
So each of these structures is trailing. They have long tails going out. And those are the same sort of trailing structures you can see in slide 43. Let's see if I go back to that. That's the simulation on the right-hand side.
Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah, so because of the differential rotation, because the particles closer to Saturn are orbiting faster than the particles further away, all these structures are sort of stretched out in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So
is there a compositional change between the mass and the what?
Not that we know of. And so it could be that if these things are more permanent, that the outer parts are getting more meteoritic bombardment. There could be some compositional differences. But what we think is that they're very temporary, that they come together and come apart, and I'm going to show you that just in the movie in just a few seconds here.
Got it.
So I'm on slide 45, which is a frame from a movie that where we follow in a computer the dynamics of a distribution of particles. They have various sizes running from a few centimeters up to about 25 meters, and the sizes are drawn in this picture, so you can see dots of different sizes. And in the center, we put a big particle, which could be one of these moonlets, and it could be something that had grown from the sort of processes you're going to see in the movie here. So if we look at that, we go to the next slide. Now this is another movie here, and hopefully you'll see it start. What I'm seeing on my screen is that original seed gradually growing clumps of material, some of which sticks and some of which comes off. Anybody else see that?
Yes.
So this is what we think is happening in the rings, is these temporary aggregations are caused by the gravity of the particles, and the particles stick together to make temporary structures, and then the temporary structures disrupt. And both the photographs of the F-ring and our own occultations, where we watch stars pass behind the F-ring, are showing us some of these structures that show that the accretion process can't be ignored in the rings. That is, particles stick together as well as breaking apart. So that's the process which I'm claiming can recycle the material in the rings, use it again and again, and make the original material in the rings be able to last a lot longer. So the next picture I've got is...
This is Joe Pateski at JPL.
Yeah.
The simulation, what is the time interval over which that runs?
So I think this is about 100 orbits, which would be a couple of months.
Wow.
So if the rings are billions of years old, this has had the chance to happen many, many times. And so even if many of these clumps come apart, maybe some of them stick together, and those are the ones that could potentially grow to be big enough to be moons that could be shattered later to form future rings.
It also looks like that seed is about, the radius is maybe about a tenth of a kilometer.
Yeah, you can see that on the side. It's 25 meters in radius is what I think.
Do you have any sense yet about if there's a minimum size for what an effective seed needs to be, or?
So this worked. It has to be bigger than the next biggest particle by a factor of several. So in this distribution, the next biggest particles, as you can see, are a few meters across. I think it's 12 meters, 6 meters. So the seed has to be significantly bigger than that. Otherwise, you don't get this phenomenon occurring.
And it looks like this is mostly stickiness as opposed to self-gravitation? Or?
No, it's all gravity.
Wow.
There's no adhesion in this.
Wow.
I was in Finland last week, and Heikki Salo showed me some similar simulations where he's put in stickiness, and you get even more clumping, as you might guess.
One last question for now. Since you've got a what you think might be a minimum size in some ways about what would be an effective seed, and you have some idea about at how long it takes for the particle size to go to zero, does this give you some sense of some kind of time scale? Or what am I asking?
So the time scales of accretion are very rapid. They're on days to months. So they're infinitesimal compared to the age of the rings, even if they're only 100 million years old, what we would call young.
I guess there's
plenty of time for this to happen. If you're asking what sort of rate do we have to make bodies that are bigger,
yes.
So then it's sufficient if this simulation, if we ran it 100,000 times, and in one case, we got a moon out of it. That's fast enough to recycle the material in the rings.
Yes.
Let me go on to the next slide, which is the 2D autocorrelation. This just shows from our occultation data that we can actually see. Maybe see is too strong. We can detect these waves. Go on to the next slide. We take that data in the previous slide and turn it into a picture of the rings. This is our picture. This is now not theory or computer simulation. This is what our data show. And you can see that in the rings we get these clumps of material with trailing sort of leftward leaning structure. So our data, our observations from Cassini, are a direct confirmation of the predictions of these models, like the one I showed you the movie of. And here's from a different model, this by Stuart Robbins and Glenn Stewart, of what happens to the rings as we put more and more material in it. And you can see from the left there's six of these simulations for different values of the amount of material, which is given by this little Greek letter tau, which would be the a measure of how much the particles geometrically cover the whole area of the ring. So where tau is 0.25, the ring particles cover 25% of the whole area of the rings. And what happens is very quickly they clump up, as you can see, and especially as the optical depth tau, as the amount of material gets bigger. And what's the second, below each of these figures, there are two numbers. The first one is what we started with, and the second one is what the coverage is after we run the model to equilibrium. And you can see that even though, let's take the bottom right one, even though the amount of material would cover the whole rings to a factor of two, that is, on the average, there'd be two particles you'd have to go through if you shot a bullet through the rings. When we get done with the numerical simulation, that the actual coverage is only 0.46, so that would mean more than half the bullets that were shot through the rings would not hit anything. And so this is, I'm talking about bullets, but you could think of the same thing with photons from a star, the light from a star. So what this means is, even though there's a lot of material in the rings, that a lot of light gets through because it's all clumped up. And I admit to this myself, when I estimated the mass of the rings back in 1983 from the Voyager data, I assumed the rings were completely homogeneous, and therefore the amount of light that got through the rings told me how much mass there was in the rings. And now you can see from our data from Cassini that sort of extrapolation is totally incorrect and would underestimate the amount of material in the rings by a factor of maybe five. So the rings then could be much more massive than we had thought from the Voyager data. And that's not a bad thing, because if the rings are much more massive, there's much more material that can be recycled and used to make future rings, and they'll last a lot longer. So going on to the next slide, we can say something then about what's a model for the ring history. And this is my particular model based on my experience with the Voyager data, modified very seriously by what we found out from Cassini in just the last few years. So we believe that Saturn's rings were created when a moon was shattered by a meteorite impact. And, of course, the pieces formed a ring around the planet. But there is recycling. The pieces can recollect to form new moons, which are then shattered later to form new rings, which then form new moons, and so on. It's the next slide. And therefore, recycling, just like it allows us to extend our natural resources on the Earth, allows the rings to be as old as the solar system, although continually changing. And because the rings have more mass than previously thought, they can last that whole time and still be bright and icy after 4 billion years. And so this is sort of the Cassini answer, or my answer based on some Cassini results, of the answer to the question of, are the rings young or old? And the answer is yes. The rings are young and the rings are old. The material has been around for a long time, and it is in the form now of rings and moons. And the moons are recollecting to form, the rings are recollecting to form moons, and the moons are being shattered in competing processes that give, at every moment, a different realization of the rings. But rings will be forever in this example. And, you know, usually wherever I'm telling this story, I take an example of a metropolitan area. When I told this explanation at the Coast Bar meeting in Beijing, I explained that, Beijing is just full of the most modern construction. There's cranes everywhere, and they're building all sorts of new roads and apartments and buildings. But at the same time, the material that's being used, in some cases, the marble came from ancient dynasties that have been used in buildings before. And even if you walk down the street, you'll never see a person in Peking that's much older than 100 years old, but Beijing has been around for thousands of years. And so in the same way, because of this continual renewal in the rings, the features we see in the rings are quite youthful and short-lived, but the rings themselves are continually changing, continually renewing, and will likely be there a billion years from now if another civilization sends out a spacecraft to the moon Saturn, the moon's and planet Saturn. So that's my story here. That's an implication of how the Cassini data are extending, and perhaps paradoxically extending, what we knew from Voyager to get exactly the opposite answer. So from Voyager, we concluded the rings were young, only as old as the dinosaurs. Now we can conclude that the rings are as old as the planets, billions of years old, but continually renewed. So, thanks for your attention. I'll take any questions anybody has.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. This is Jane. I think Trina's on also still. And if anybody has any questions, we have some more time. Also, for those of you who didn't, like I didn't, download the two movies, they are definitely on the password protected site, so you can go back and look at them again afterwards. Okay.
I have a question.
Sure. And could you please state your name, please?
Yeah, this is Pete Doldy, and my question is, hi Jane. Do you think as part of the extended mission, you'll actually be able to image some of the clumping in a way to support your theory?
So to get pictures of those, we need to get close to the rings again, and that's not planned. We'll never get as close again in the extended mission as we did in some of those first photographs I showed you when we went into orbit. But in the extended mission, which is a proposal we're going to make to NASA to extend the Cassini mission to the time of Midsummer's Day, the summer solstice on Saturn, in that mission, the near the end, the spacecraft gets very close to the rings and flies just over them multiple times. So it's possible in an extended mission that we would get close enough to the rings to take even higher detail pictures to look for some of these temporary moons and clumps. In the meantime, we still watch stars going behind the rings, and every week we get a new set of data. So in the extended mission, we're going to look at maybe 50 more stars, which is going to allow us to improve the detail of our tomography, but probably that's not quite like seeing it yourself in a photograph.
On the extended mission, are you talking about the possibility of doing orbits? Was that inside the D-ring?
Yes.
And what distance do you think you'd be if you were able to image those?
So what would be the range to the rings?
Mm-hmm.
Could be as low as 10 or 15,000 kilometers.
Wow.
And that...
And the velocity would be quite high, would it not, of the orbiter?
The velocity would be, yes, higher. So there's a question of smear, which hasn't been worked out yet. You'll have to ask the camera team lead about that.
Thank you.
Larry, one of the questions I'm getting a lot, and I thought maybe I would just ask you, is what about spokes? We haven't really seen such dramatic spokes as we saw in the Voyager days, and what are you thinking about that?
So it's not a complete embarrassment because, you know, eventually after the start of the mission, we did see some spokes, but they're in no way as spectacular as what was seen by Voyager. And I think that's also a seasonal effect. So I'm predicting as the season advances toward the equinox in the next year or two that we will see much more spectacular spoke images because that was the season when Voyager saw them.
Okay, thanks.
Related to the spoke question, is there movement of those spoke-like particles along the radius? Does it change in distance? I think that those particles change distance or orbits around Saturn.
Yeah, from the Voyager data, we saw spokes form over radial distances of 10,000 kilometers from Saturn in a matter of minutes. So that would either imply that the particles are moving that rapidly or there's some sort of electromagnetic phenomenon. And I would say it's more likely the latter. And what the individual spoke particles do is they have very limited range. They move up and down mostly, but very little inward or outward.
So they would be lifted, if you would, off of the rings and then descend back down to the same orbit.
Right. So it's sort of like you're at the stadium and the wave goes by. You know, people raise their arms and put them down. The wave goes around the stadium in about 10 or 15 seconds, but nobody's running. Nobody's moving that rapidly. So that would be how I'd explain those apparent velocities as a wave-like phenomenon, electromagnetic phenomenon, where, like in the stadium, the little particles stand up and then come back down.
Would the radio science experiments be able to detect whatever energy is producing that?
So radio science is not the best, but the radio and plasma wave spectrometer has detected radio signals from the rings that are consistent with some of these electromagnetic phenomena. One possibility is that a lightning strike on Saturn could start one of these waves. And so that's a proposal to cause the spokes as a result of electrical activity in Saturn's atmosphere. And definitely the RPWS experiment has seen electrical activity, lightning storms, in Saturn's atmosphere that could power the spoke activity. But the visibility of the spokes is still, as Trina said, not as good as it was in Voyager, so we may, if they do come back, as I predict, it will be easier to do those cross comparisons in about a year.
One other question. On approach to Saturn, there was some, I think I remember hearing of a detector of a burst of oxygen being seen, perhaps related to a meteor impact. I haven't heard much about that since.
Yeah, those were our results, which we reported in Science magazine from the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. We're able to map out the system, and in the same way that we looked at hydrogen in those auroral images, we can focus on the color of oxygen and map the oxygen in the Saturn system. And we think that that oxygen is coming from those same plumes on Enceladus. So it's not coming from a meteoritic impact, but from water molecules that are erupted off of the moon Enceladus that are then impacted by electrons and broken apart by sunlight to make oxygen and hydrogen atoms. And those oxygen atoms eventually escape the system. And in the meantime, we're able to measure their distribution and their lifetimes, which are consistent with eruption processes and processes in the magnetosphere of Saturn.
Thank you very much. That answers a lot of old questions.
Mm-hmm.
One question here. This is Kevin from Albuquerque again. As you look at some of those photos, do you really see that it appears that the coagulation of the various moons are very different? And I guess my question is, in thinking about what you just presented, because I'm going to have to rewrite some of my lectures here, how do you determine the mass of a moon when it's embedded in a ring like that? And if it is embedded in that ring, would the edges along the ring, would that tell us about mass?
So, of course, since we're looking at gravitational phenomena, that directly gives the masses here. And one way we can tell the masses of objects in the rings is because they are able to shepherd the ring edges or exclude some ring particles. And the cameras have shown features that they call propellers, which are sort of nascent ring edges where the moon is just big enough to sort of push particles away from it by its gravity, but not big enough to make a gap, an annular gap in the rings. And so from those gravitational interactions, we can estimate the sizes of some particles in the A-ring of being 50 to a few hundred meters across. And in the same way, when we look at our star occultations, we can measure the width of the features that block the light. And we find widths between 27 meters and 9 kilometers. Pictures of moons in the rings, the moons that have been found, are typically a few kilometers, 3 to 6 kilometers across.
Wow. Would the... As the moon coagulates, would that cause any, maybe not perturbations, but maybe eccentricities of the path of the moon in the ring itself?
So there's an interplay between the moon and the rings. And so the moon has a directly observable effect on the rings, which has been observed in the camera images in these propellers. Over time, the interaction between the gravity of the particles and the moon can't be ignored, and the growing moonlet will be pushed around, but we can't say exactly how far or how much yet.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Yes, you're welcome.
This is Robert Bigelow, Solar System Ambassador in Salt Lake City. I'm still a little bit confused about the end result of the collisional cascade, if that were the only thing happening. When you say the ring material would be used up, does that mean it just, really small sized, or does it actually get pulled out of the...
Ground to dust, that's the first part. So both your answers are correct. The ring particles are ground to dust, and then the dust is small enough that it can be pushed around by the electromagnetic forces.
Oh, okay. So it will be pushed either or pulled into Saturn or ejected from the system?
Right, exactly. And the ones that are pulled into Saturn, those little grains will become meteorites, flashes in the sky for the Saturnian resonance. So, yes, I wasn't clear on that. The particles are eventually ground down to dust, and the dust is dragged away out of its orbit, either into the planet itself or to far space.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
So, Larry, what do you think is the big open question about the rings right now?
So I'd like to get data that would confirm this model or not, to show directly that the particles in the rings are either ancient or recent. And so the questions that are important to that, what are the key questions? What are the ring particles made of? What's their composition? And what are the sizes of the ring particles? What's the distribution of sizes? And then how do those two things evolve? How does the size change and the composition change with time? And so the key questions about this are tomography. The questions could be answered with Cassini data of tomography from more occultations, some close-up images, and from spectroscopy of the rings that measures their composition. So those, Trina, you're probably thinking, those are the same questions we had when we went into orbit. They're still the same questions. What's the structure of the rings? What's the composition of the rings? And what's their distribution and sizes? And now we know better, but we haven't yet got a definitive answer from that about what's the history of the rings.
Okay, thanks.
Larry, Bob Taplow, Dundee, Illinois.
Yes.
Got another question for you. The thickness of the rings. It seems like every time I hear new information, latest estimate on the thickness of the rings keeps getting thinner and thinner and thinner.
Right. This has been going on for 30 years, that phenomenon.
Are we going to stop before we end up with paper-thin rings?
So rings are already thinner in a relative sense than a sheet of paper. I mean, they're definitely flatter than a pancake. They stretch from here to the moon, and in some places we measure the thickness, it's like 20 feet. So they're really some of the flattest systems we know, and there are a couple of points to be remembered. I've been talking about the ring particles are not all the same size. So the rings may be thinner than the biggest particles in them. So the largest ring particles may be tens of meters across or hundreds of meters, and the rings themselves could be just meters thick. And furthermore, the little particles tend to have more vertical excursions than the bigger particles, so we can't just talk about the thickness of the rings. The most massive particles are, biggest particles are most likely in a very, very flattened system. The smaller particles, like the dust that causes the spokes, may have excursions of tens or hundreds of meters away from the ring plane. I don't know if that's helping you visualize this at all, but they are absolutely one of the thinnest, flattest phenomena that we've ever observed.
Okay. That's like sheets of sandpaper with bumps on it.
Yeah, and in fact, embedded stones in the sandstone in the sandpaper.
Well, unless anybody has any other questions, I'd like to thank Larry for this awesome talk. It was really great, and I thought a lot of people had wonderful questions. Our next Charm Telecon will be on June 24th, and it'll be our annual anniversary episode. So what we'll be doing is gathering kind of the summary of what Cassini's been up to for the last year, the fourth year of the Prime mission. So that one will be good to put on your calendar.
Jane, could I just mention that since we had so much material in the last anniversary talk, the plan is to split the anniversary talk across both June and July. So we'll have the first half in June and the second half in July.
Fantastic.
So I want to, I've got just a moment left. Thanks for those kind words, Jane. But I just want to give a slightly simpler answer to Trina's question about what can Cassini tell us about the history of the rings.
Okay, great.
And so we can't directly measure the history or the origin of the rings. There's no single experiment that does that. But we can measure the composition of the rings from the spectrometers. We can measure the structure of the rings from the cameras and the occultations. And that tells us the dynamics of the rings, how they're moving, how they're changing. And from that, we can play the movie backwards to get the history and the origin of the rings. That was one of the first tasks that Cassini set for the mission, and we're still working on that task.
Okay, thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome.
And thank you, everyone, for calling in. I know this was a busy day here at NASA with a press conference on Mars, also at 11 o'clock. And a lot of our Museum Alliance people were called into a special Mars after party. And,
beautiful.
And so what I'm going to do with these people is, as soon as the wave file, the audio is done, I'm going to remind all the museums that this whole package is there for them, for those who missed it. So with that, we'll say goodbye.
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 Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.